First committee to order. Today is Friday, February 10th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and my staff, Clark Bickford, committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we have first hearing on Rep. McCabe's HB 29, and then a second hearing on three bills previously heard from Representative Stanley Wright, Representative Andy Josephson, and Representative Zach Fields. First up, we'll be hearing from Representative Kevin McCabe. Please come to the table and start your presentation. It's the committee's intent to hear and hold this bill for a second hearing. And let the record reflect that Representative Ruffridge and Representative Fields joined us at 3:16 p.m.
Good afternoon, Chair Sumner, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for hearing HB 29. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, representative for House District 30. With me, I have my staff, Buddy Witt, here at the table. And this is for the bill introduction. So insurance companies are in the business, actually, of discrimination. Insurers segregate the insured into separate risk pools based on their differences in risk profiles for two main reasons. One is so that they can charge different premiums to the different groups based on their risk. And the other is to incentivize risk reduction by the insured. There are, however, limits to the type of discrimination that insurers can engage in. Those discrimination restriction decisions are decided at the national and at the local levels of government, and laws on discrimination and intensity of regulation vary a great deal in each jurisdiction. Insurance companies have been denying coverage to Alaskans based solely on their political affiliation, expression, and/or elected status. This bill seeks to prohibit insurance discrimination based solely on those factors. Specifically, House Bill 29 amends the insurance code in Alaska from using political expression, affiliation, or status as a public official as the sole reason to refuse to insure or refuse to renew insurance coverage, to limit the scope of insurance coverage, to cancel an existing insurance policy, to deny a claim covered by an existing insurance policy, or increase the premium, policy fees, or rates charged on an insurance policy. I want to emphasize this point. This bill would not prohibit refusals, limitations, or fees that are based on sound underwriting or actuarial principles. Given that insurance products are necessary to protecting health and property, and in some instances even required by law, I believe that it is in the public interest to ensure that consumers are protected from discriminatory practices. I believe that Bill 29 helps in that effort. And with that, I'll let staffer Buddy Witt read the sectional, if you'd like, and the sponsor statement as well, if you'd like.
Please go ahead, Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. You just go through the sectional? Okay. It's a pretty straightforward sectional. The bill, House Bill 29, is comprised of two sections. In Section 1, we amend Alaska Statute 21.36 to add a new section that prohibits a person transacting insurance in this state from discriminating against a person based solely on a person's political affiliation or expression, or a person's status as an elected state official as defined in AS 4499205. Then Section 2 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section regarding applicability and effective dates to insurance policies and or contracts.
Questions? Anybody? Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, have you talked to insurance providers about this bill, these provisions in these bills?
Yes.
And what did you find out? Follow-up, excuse me.
So insurance providers said basically that if you are an elected, some insurance providers, and I'm not going to name the names here, but Some insurance providers said that if you are an elected official, they will not provide certain aspects of their policy that they provide to other Alaskans,
right.
Namely an umbrella policy.
Right. Okay. And the key word was some. Are there, I used to sell insurance and I know exactly what you're talking about, but are there insurance companies that will provide that coverage doing business in Alaska?
So I hesitate to say this, but after I put this bill in the queue, I heard that there were other insurance companies, or there were insurance companies that said that they would provide.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Fields. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, is Director William Heyer online?
Not seeing her online.
Okay.
We will be holding this bill over.
Got it. Maybe I'll just ask the questions for her next time. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I am just kind of curious what might have precipitated this legislation. Did you hear from elected officials or folks who had been denied insurance coverage? If you could just give like a quick synopsis of some of the background here.
Yes, I have talked to several elected officials that have been denied coverage because umbrella policies because of their status as an elected official.
And follow up. Through the chair, at what level, the municipal level, state? I mean, you know, I'm just curious who this is impacting most.
Both actually, and school board as well.
Really quick, we actually do have Lori Wingheyer's assistant, Greg Smith, here if there are questions.
Sure.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. I'm more just wondering along the lines of just the statutory definition of discrimination from my perspective with insurance companies. Feel like sometimes in many cases insurance is in the business of discriminating, and so. Is there a particular definition of discrimination attached to this bill to help me understand, I guess, would this in some cases raise insurance costs because their discriminatory practices is sometimes what allows them to keep down costs to others?
So I'll let Mr. Witt answer part of that, but I will tell you that, yes, we figure that it may raise costs. The discrimination factor comes on November 7th, somebody is eligible for a certain policy, and then he's elected, and on November 8th, he's not eligible. To me, that's a whole lot different than he gets his driver's license and he's eligible for insurance, and then he gets 20 tickets, and all of a sudden his insurance goes up. There's a different level. As I mentioned early on in the presentation, a different level of discrimination. There's a reason that their insurance companies are allowed to discriminate for a bad driver, say. But just being, in my opinion, and this bill seeks to address that, just being elected shouldn't bring your level up to that point, or the level of discrimination, if you will.
And
I think...
Representative Ruffridge?
Yeah, and just to follow up to that before Mr. Witt, so that makes a lot of sense to me. So on one day you're offered the coverage, on the next you're not. Is that happening as a result of an assumed amount of risk as an elected official? Do you have I guess some of the background behind why they're making that decision, because I guess there would have to be an assumption of new risk there, it seems like.
So it's a little unclear.
Representative McCabe, please address your comments through the chair.
Sorry. Thank you. Through the chair. Minor. Thanks, Chair Sumner. Thanks. Through the chair. Yes, there are actuarials that talk about risk. And I just haven't seen one that talks about the risk of being a public official. So I don't really have a good, clear answer to that question. We can certainly do some more research on it and figure it out.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fields.
I'll just hold questions for next time. Okay, thank you.
Representative Sattler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I apologize if I have missed this in your presentation, but have any insurers that you know explicitly stated that the reason for denying umbrella coverage is because of the client's or the applicant's status as a public official?
Yes.
They have indeed. Can you amplify on how they've done so, like in writing? Or
people have, through the chair, sorry, yes. And they have, people have told me that they applied for an umbrella policy, and the insurer told them that since they were a public official, elected public official, and in one case a school board, which is elected as well, that they would not provide them with an umbrella policy. And they didn't even really, you know, you might assume that there is, they would have provided, but it had an increased cost. This particular insurer just said no.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. We will set aside HB 29.
Oh.
Representative Brox, I apologize.
I'm sorry. I was slow on the uptake there. I would like to hear from, was it Mr. Smith with the State Division of Insurance, if he has something to add to this.
Thank you, Greg Smith, Legislative Liaison to the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and an inadequate substitute for Director Wingheyer here. But I guess just a couple of points that in my conversations with her might be useful for the committee. Insurance companies are able to discriminate but not discriminate unfairly. It does not lay out in statute what the different protected classes are, but in my conversation with Ms. Wingheyer, I believe there are some known types of class that you could not discriminate on race, anyway, some of those, I could not find those in statute. And then maybe another piece, insurance companies will and often do not provide coverage. I believe the term Director Wingheyer used was people of notoriety. You could expect Bill Gates or something, people who might be continued targets of lawsuits. And as such, I'm sure he is able to get coverage somewhere, but they will in some cases not provide coverage for these types because of additional risk.
Representative Brox.
Thank you. Through the chair, we're specifically talking about umbrella coverage, which is excess liability coverage over the liability coverage that's in a regular homeowner's policy. Again, drawing on my memory, and I hope this is still correct because it applies to me. The homeowner's liability coverage does provide, at least the company that I'm insured by, does provide some protection for the sort of things that public officials, what you say in, what is it, slander, and I forget the other definition now. The homeowner's coverage does provide that. It's just at a lower limit. Do you know of any homeowners' policies or companies that would exclude somebody from getting liability coverage on a homeowner's policy because of these same conditions that are expressed in these bills?
Representative Prox, through the chair, I will have to connect with Director Wingheyer and get you an answer.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Smith. I'm under the impression that we have, under the Department of Administration, a special department of risk that has certain levels of potential coverage, especially in regards to liability for members of either the administration or potentially elected officials. I'm not 100% certain on the mechanisms of that department. Is that a potential for some of these discriminatory issues is that this body or maybe other bodies carry already some sort of liability protections for those elected officials?
Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, I'm unsure how the State Department of Administration's impact would be on in terms of indemnification for members of the administration. I believe through official actions, you as legislators, assembly members, school board members are indemnified in certain cases. My understanding is maybe where this issue is coming up and why a legislator was denied umbrella coverage was just for that additional risk on things that they are not indemnified for. But I don't know if I'm answering your question, and I can get you a better answer or a fuller answer.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I guess I have a similar question to Representative Ruffridge's earlier question. I'm just wondering about some of the reasons why there would be an extra risk to being a public official and sort of some color around why the coverage would be denied on those grounds. And then additionally, political affiliation is in here. So I'm curious, we don't have a definition of political affiliation in this bill. Can you, Representative McCabe, talk about, are we talking about registered political party? Or are we talking about if someone says they're, a communist or something, what are we talking about in terms of scope here? And are there scenarios where folks have been denied insurance coverage explicitly because they state a certain political affiliation?
I am unaware, through the chair, I am on Representative McCabe, sorry. I'm unaware of any in Alaska that have been denied because of political affiliation. We modeled this bill after a bill that was written in Texas where there was some issues with that, apparently. And so we included the political affiliation as part of the discrimination. And I think political affiliation is exactly what you just said it was. It's a party affiliation, an ideology affiliation, whether it be Republican, Democrat, Communist. That's why we put that in there.
Representative Prox.
I think Representative Carrick asked more or less the question I was going to ask. And maybe just to follow up to that, your intent on this bill is to leave the political affiliation or expression in there. You want that to be part of this bill. Obviously.
Sure.
Something to think about.
Through the chair, so as we, Representative McCabe, so as we crafted this bill and developed this bill, we looked at different laws from different states, and the one in Texas seemed to make the most sense to us. And, yeah, I would certainly love to leave the political affiliation in there. I don't think we should discriminate insurance for anything other than the law sort of allows, or they do it another way. They reverse discriminate and they do it properly. If you want to plug the little thing into your lighter that limits your speed limit or shows your speed limit to the insurance company, you can get reduced rates. So I get all of that, and I get that they discriminate with rates for somebody that has a lot of tickets and that sort of thing. So that's what insurance companies do, and I think that's what's allowed. My intent with this bill, there's already a problem in the state of Alaska with people wanting to run for legislature or to run for elected office because there are so many of these kinds of things around. People look at that and they say, well, I can't run for legislature. I need an umbrella policy for my business. Mm-hmm. And if I lose that, I put my business at risk. So my intent with this bill was to prevent that.
Just quick follow-up. I'm sorry, I haven't looked through the documents that are already on BASIS, but is the Texas law that was a model for this and the documentation, maybe some behind that to give us more information, is that available?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe for the record. I can get that information. And additionally, I have a white paper that you might find interesting that deals with the discrimination that was written by a PhD student from the University of Texas that gives broad information about risk pools, risk assessments, and discrimination within individual risk pools. And if I may, Mr. Chair, going back to a question from Vice Chair Ruffridge, there are, when speaking of discrimination, particularly within the insurance industry in Alaska, Section 2136.090 talks about unfair discrimination within differing risk pools for things like health insurance, transportation insurance, life insurance, et cetera. But there is an idea when it comes to discrimination, there isn't, for lack of a better word, an umbrella policy within discrimination of protected classes. So within individual risk pools, you can't discriminate, say, for being from the Kenai Peninsula or being a woman or being a male. That is a protected class. Additionally, of course, we have within Title 18 the establishment and organization of the Commission for Human Rights, which will take individual discrimination cases within particular practices, complaints from those who believe they've been discriminated against, and we'll follow up on those to make sure that those protected classes are indeed being protected in the state of Alaska. So this is a new piece of legislation under Title 21, particularly to this, and identifying it as not a protected class, but an area where you cannot discriminate just within the insurance industry. If that helps to answer the question you had previously.
Representative Sandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I lament the need for proceeding for this kind of legislation, but the bill is currently written, cites the definition of elected state official in 44-99-205 to limit it just to the legislature, lieutenant governor, and governor roughly. Could this bill be made even better if you extended it to all elected officials? You mentioned school board members are also elected, as are assembly members, as are maybe some mayors or vice or deputy mayors and so forth. Did you leave that state official in there on purpose, or could this be made better by deleting the state?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, yes, it absolutely could be made better. Okay. I was a little unclear if that might be a step too far. So I thought we'd start with this, and if we need to amend it, or if, frankly, if there are more school board members or other assembly members or city council members that think that this that have had the same problem and think that this is a good bill for them, I'm happy to entertain an amendment or put it in myself for that.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. And Representative McCabe, did you have any further testimony today on this bill?
No, Chair Sumner, I appreciate the opportunity to present HB 29, and I'm happy to answer any questions, happy to come back, and certainly I will whatever questions that we came up with here that I couldn't answer, we will get them to you if you want.
Okay. I do believe there were some questions that information was going to be brought back, so please do that, and we will set aside HB 29 for public hearing at a later date. Thank you. Next up, we have HB 51 from Representative Stanley Wright. Please come to the table. We will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Okay. Seeing none, are there any testifiers online? Looks like we might have Mike Nerozzi. Mr. Nerozzi, go ahead if you would like to testify. We are going to be limiting testimony to 2 minutes today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Sumner and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Mike Nerozzi. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. Thank you for allowing me to speak today with you and convey AHRI's strong support for House Bill 51, sponsored by Representative Wright, which will provide American manufacturers in the heating, ventilation, air conditioning, refrigeration industry with the certainty needed to comply with forthcoming federal regulations phasing down the use of hydrofluorocarbon refrigerants. AHRI represents more than 330 manufacturers of air conditioning, heating, commercial refrigeration, and water heating equipment. Our member companies produce more than 90% of the residential and commercial air conditioning, heating, commercial refrigeration from the HVAC air conditioning, heating, and commercial refrigeration equipment made in North America. In North America, the annual economic activity resulting from our industry is approximately $256 billion. In the United States alone, AHRI member companies, along with distributors, contractors, and technicians, employ more than 1.3 million people, including more than 700 jobs in Alaska. In December 2020, the American Innovation and Manufacturing Act, otherwise known as the AIM Act, was signed into law by President Trump, which directs the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to issue rules that will phase out the use of current refrigerants, restricting their use in certain applications such as commercial refrigeration, chillers, and air conditioning. This allows for an orderly transition to next-generation refrigerants, many of which are made in the United States. However, our manufacturers face a pressing challenge. Building codes need to be updated this year to remove regulatory barriers to the use of these new refrigerants. Efforts are underway to do so both in Alaska and across the country, but regulatory timelines for these efforts are 2 to 3 years away. This would be too late for American consumers, American manufacturers, and Alaskan consumers. HB 51 amends state building code to allow any substitute refrigerant deemed safe under federal standards to be used in Alaska. This will eliminate the mismatch of the building code schedule and enable the use of new refrigerants 1 to 2 years earlier, ensuring that there's no disruption for consumers by making new products available for sale in Alaska on the same schedule as other states. In short, HB 51 eliminates the timing barrier without imposing any new regulatory standards. It simply allows for the harmonization with the 2024 model codes, benefiting consumers and businesses that rely on air conditioning and refrigeration equipment. Thank you again for the opportunity to present testimony at this hearing. AHRI looks forward to continuing to work with the Alaska State Legislature to achieve both the economic and environmental benefits of the phase down of HFC.
Thank you, Mr. Nerozzi. It sounds like you were reading from prepared testimony. You might want to submit that in writing as well. Representative Prox, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Yes, through the chair, I'm wondering if this wouldn't, by the language, apply to firefighting agents. Specifically, what I'm thinking about is Haemon, which is a chlorinated fluorocarbon, or I can't remember all the names, but do we need to do something similar for those firefighting agents?
For that question to Helen Walter Caranoni. She's our Vice President of Regulatory Affairs, who's also on the line.
Thank you. Halon's,
Okay, so we're going to, do you guys have invited testimony you wanted to bring back? Is that the case? Or
through the chair for the record, Forrest Wolf, staff representative, right? Yes, we have Mike and Helen online. They were okay. Testified last meeting. They had their prepared testimony, but they were also here to answer questions as well.
All right, so we were doing public testimony, and I didn't realize that you guys wanted to do. So if we want to do invited testimony from the other guest, could we have her state her name and her affiliation, and she can go ahead and testify? Yeah. Sorry about that.
My name is Helen Walter Caranoni, and I work for the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute as the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs. To the question around Halons, Halons are not impacted by this proposal in the building codes. I hope that helps.
I'm wondering if you know whether we need to look at those agents as well in the building code. You might not, but if you do, if you could help us out.
To the chair, this is Helen Walter Caranoni again, AHRI. So my understanding is that the fire suppressants are protected at this time until 2025 in the AIM Act. So there's still time to make updates if necessary around any listings there. I will follow up to see if anything is needed, but I'm not aware of anything at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Wolf, did you have anything you wanted to add on behalf of Representative Wright?
Through the chair, nothing more than just he apologizes for not being in attendance today.
Okay, well, so it looks like we have nobody else on the line. Is there anybody else on the in the room that would like to testify on HB 51? No? Okay, so we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Representative Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill number 51, version alpha, also referred to as 33LS0334/A, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 51 has been moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. House Labor and Commerce Committee will come back to order. Next up is HB 13 from Representative Andy Josephson. Please come to the table. We will open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room who wishes to testify? No? Okay. Let's see. Is there anybody online that wishes to testify? I don't see anybody. No? Okay. We will close public testimony. Were there any questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Prox?
Well, just I guess maybe a question to bill sponsor, but everyone. That one of my concerns about this bill is that, and actually I think it's under current statute, that it applies to anybody that employs one employee up. And from reading through some of the prior cases and whatnot that the Human Rights Commission deals with, there's a risk of these discrimination cases essentially being weaponized, and real small, if you will, family scale businesses have a hard time defending themselves, and they just choose to go along with it, and that has and can cause future problems. So I'm wondering if it would be worthwhile addressing and discussing that, if the will of others would be to hold this bill and get into that discussion. Maybe I'll ask that of the sponsor. Is he in favor of doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, it'll come as no surprise that I'm not in favor of that. If there was some data about it being weaponized by employees, for example, of small businesses or small nonprofits, then I think the committee should entertain those. I would say that one of the benefits of the whole system is that an employer or landlord, for example, shouldn't need to lawyer up in the first instance, because the committee would have to find, or rather the commission and its staff would have to find substantial evidence of some sort of discrimination. And they do a pretty good job, and we answered that for you, in vetting these things and reducing them to legitimate cases.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? No? Vice Chair Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 13, version alpha, also referred to as 33-LS0208/A, be advanced from the committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Representative Prox?
Object.
Okay, there is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright is absent. Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
No.
And Chair Sumner.
Yes. Hey.
The vote.
You don't have.
Oh, sorry. You don't have to. Go ahead.
The vote is 4 yeses, a no, and an absence. Five yeses.
Okay, so with that, HB 13 is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record, and just a matter of cleanup. With a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, House Bill 13 was moved from committee. So last we have HB 46 from Representative Zach Fields. Please come to the table.
The committee's intent is to hear and hold this bill for a third hearing. We'll open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Oh, come on up. We're making good time, so please state your name, and we'll limit testimony to 3 minutes.
Oh, no. Only three?
Yeah.
My name is Kayla Savinicki. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee, Zach, for bringing us here today. And so I just want to speak from my personal experience and also talking about my program and the families that we serve and the providers who work with me. So first, I'm a lifelong resident of Alaska, 3 kids of my own. My husband works in construction. So we understand the needs of our community's workforce. And so the reason that I'm in childcare to begin with is because when I had my third son, childcare was unaffordable for my family. And so moving into childcare as a home care provider 5 years ago, it became immediately clear that I needed more education. I needed more training. The kids and families, they needed more from me to be able to provide good service. And so I went ahead and did that. And over the last 5 years, I've grown into a group home. I've grown into small, mid, and large scale centers. And now I'm the director of my own child care center, Ox Lake Preschool, and after school here in Juneau, in Ox Bay, and we currently have 75 enrolled children and families and 25 full-time staff, 4 part-time staff. And so we serve a lot of people and we employ a lot of educators. And so we've continued operations through the pandemic, and as you can imagine, a lot has changed since then. So it was difficult before, and we're very thankful for the relief that has come down. However, we're having even more of a challenging time meeting those needs that were difficult to meet before coming from the pandemic. And so I have some notes here just so that I don't lose my train of thought. But I have all of my staff here with me today. They're downstairs. There's over 20 of us. And so they're here to kind of talk from the provider and the educator perspective, that we love what we do. We work extremely long hours. Those of us who have families in this room, our providers are there before we go to work. They're ready to accept our children. They are enriching their days all day long, and they're there when we get off of work, and they're getting unlivable wages. And as a business, being an employer, our childcare business is not supported in that way, how other businesses are supported. We have enough to, it comes off of the backs of the families. Exactly what we make and how we run our business comes from the tuition that we make. And that hasn't increased for tens of years because we want to make sure that families can afford it. And so look at the market prices of childcare, how much it costs, just what we know in science behaviorally, what kids need as far as like ACEs. Am I on getting okay with time? Okay. But we're required to have more technical knowledge. And so we need to know how to work with these children in a way to where we understand their development. We understand psychology. We understand teaching. We understand teaching. And so we need that training, and we work so many hours that getting that training costs money, takes extra time. You can imagine the list goes on. It just is every facet you can think of. And so our issue is that we're underfunded. The regulations, the state regulations, they require amendments so that we can meet these regulations. We need to look at the people who are available. Start coming to my point, right? Okay, so now what we want is we want the ability to bargain and collectively come together, which now we're not allowed to do. It says that we're not allowed to do it. And also we need funding that comes directly to the providers. Thank you.
Question, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, ma'am? I believe you said you have, currently you have 75 children and 25 staff.
Correct.
Is that a regulatory requirement, or could you handle more children if they were available to you?
Oh, absolutely. Our wait list is very long, and our building could offer more capacity. However, that was limited by the state, and so, yes, we could have more children.
Right, but you're right now you have roughly 3 children per staff. Is that a regulatory requirement limit?
No, the regulatory requirement is different per age stage, but we do staff more children per child. Not only is it best practice, but also it helps with staffing, which is a really huge issue right now for not just us, but everyone.
Okay. Thank you.
Good question, dear.
Representative Carey.
I'll keep it really brief. Through the chair, I'm just curious, in your estimation, staff that you may have lost or seen turnover with, are they moving to service industry jobs? Are they moving away because of salary and benefits?
Absolutely, yes. They are leaving because they are very, very long hours and not enough compensation.
And just a follow-up, just really quickly through the chair. And is it also your estimation that these individuals would stay in the child care field if they felt like they could receive those wages and compensation?
1,000%. They're all standing outside proving that very point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Amanda Triplett, and I have been a Juneau resident since 2004. My husband and I have been dealing with the child care crisis for 13 years. So we have a 13-year-old in middle school and a 4-year-old that goes to pre-K at Little Moon Auk Lake with Kayla. It is essential that Alaska has strong, reliable, and empowered child care centers across the state. We need these to get back to work. This is not an isolated incident for Juneau. Your constituents everywhere have this issue, whether it's urban or rural Alaska. We need child care. We need to empower our workers with higher wages, with more competitive wages. They are leaving this field because it's hard. If any of you have kids, you know it is hard and it is exhausting, and making $14 an hour isn't going to cut it. And I just want to show my support for HB 46 as a parent, as a community member, and as someone who wants to stay in Alaska and wants to stay here. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to test? Oh, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you.
Question.
Thank you. Through the chair. Let's see, your services are paid for in part by the state and in part by just individual families paying you, or how? Who is your payer? There we go.
That question is for me. My name is Kayla Savinicki. I'm the director of Auk Lake Preschool. And so our tuition, our income is solely tuition from what our parents are paying per child, per enrollment. We do try to supplement that with contracts with our tribal agencies, any other nonprofit partners. The city at the local level is doing a lot to try and allocate funds that takes a long time to kind of come through. And so we are getting some supplemental funds. However, our income is from families.
Okay, and follow up?
Go ahead.
Let's see. You are free to raise your prices today, correct?
Correct. And Amanda, to my side right now, that's part of what she'd like to testify about, is that families are looking at leaving Juneau because if these prices reach market pricing, market cost. And so families will leave, or they will change their lifestyles to a single income family household. If child care becomes too unaffordable, then those things will happen, and we'll also lose enrollments. We have most of our families who can't afford to pay what we already charge.
Thank you. So follow up? Just to be clear, then your expectation from this bill is that you would be able to receive some partial payment at least from the state?
Absolutely, that this is looked at as a business market failure and that we take into action how to bring this into infrastructure and supporting our child care systems for our workforce.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, ma'am, I'm sorry, I just remember your name, but...
Kayla Savinicki, Kayla.
Mrs. Savinicki, but I respect your time. As a young reporter, I earned $180 a week. I thought that was because I'd entered a low-paying profession, not because there was a business market failure.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, thank you for testifying today. So in your testimony, you had mentioned working for $14 an hour. And certainly that is a hard job to do for $14 an hour. House Bill 46 brings about the ability for child care workers to collectively bargain. How, in your opinion, will that bargaining, one, help child care workers make different wages? And two, what does that do to the cost of child care in your establishment, particular or as a parent?
Well, first, part of the ask is that there's a child care trust and that there is money that's being allocated towards child care in support of our workforce. And so we'd like to negotiate together. That's not an opportunity that we have right now. And so we would like to collectively come together on what we would like to see, what makes sense as far as our differing business structures. The reason it needs to be flexible is because a lot of our providers, we're also business owners. We run organizations and our philosophies and our theories are different from one another. And so does that answer our question?
Sure. Through the chair, if I may, just as a parent, you know, what if the cost of child, so just in the current iteration of this bill, the institution of the trust exists, but there is currently not a fiscal note for any money, and there's no appropriation of funds for that. So if House Bill 46 were to be enacted into law today, there would be the ability to collectively bargain, but potentially no funds to do, you know, that extra subsidizing piece. What do you think as a parent would be the overall ramifications to you if people bargained, maybe they had higher wages? I mean, what's the upper ceiling of what you're willing to, I guess, offer to have your child's care for?
Yeah. So my 4.5-year-old attends Kayla's preschool 3 days a week with the occasional drop-in. My February tuition was over $1,000. We're able to afford that. We do not have any state or tribal assistance that comes right out of our paychecks. Most families don't have that luxury. And I feel that with HB 46, it will elevate the voices of child care employees for child care center owners like Kayla and bring their voice together to raise up awareness that this field is essential and these laborers need to get paid a fair and equitable wage. I would love to pay them more. We cannot personally afford that. And I believe it's up to the state to step in. If you want a strong Alaska workforce, we have to have strong, reliable, consistent childcare that doesn't close with a week's notice.
Follow up, if I may.
We're actually going to take some of these other folks that online, just as a matter of fairness.
I'm sorry. Excellent.
Other,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So
Well, we're going to go ahead and go to some of the online testimony. I think we have Susan DeLouch in Palmer. Susan, are you on?
From Palmer.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello, I'm the owner of Bright Beginnings Urban Learning Center, which operates 4 child care centers in Anchorage and Eagle River. We're licensed to care for 455 children. I've owned child care centers for the past 43 years, 28 of those years in Alaska, and I've never seen such difficult operating conditions. Our centers have been operating at a substantial loss since the beginning of COVID. Operating costs are up approximately 30%, and this includes staff costs. Enrollment is down. Before COVID, we were operating at close to 100% capacity. Because of COVID, our enrollment dropped to approximately 40%. It's increasing now, but we continue to operate a lot. The difficulty of hiring qualified staff is limiting the number of children we can enroll. It is more difficult to hire and retain qualified team members now compared to before the pandemic. The Alaska Chamber of Commerce recently found that insignificant childcare reduces state economic output by $165 million annually. 77% of parents reported missing work due to inadequate childcare. 40% of respondents to the chamber survey report that someone in their household has been forced to leave work, not take a job, or change jobs due to challenges with the childcare in the past year. Quality childcare is vital for the economic recovery of our state. These difficult operating conditions have forced many childcare programs to permanently close. We were thankful for the funds made available from the PPP loan, a grant from the Anchorage Assembly, CARES, and ARPA funds. This assistance allowed us to remain open and care for Alaska's children. These sources of funding will come to an end in the near future. Without additional support, it will be very difficult for us to continue to care for the 275 children and 70 team members that are part of the Bright Beginnings family. Child care was a flawed business model before the pandemic. The cost of providing quality care is greater than most families can afford to pay, forcing providers to operate on razor-thin margins and pay nearly poverty wages to team members. Unless city, state, and federal governments pass significant early learning investments and reform, relief funding will expire, and providers will return to the status quo, perpetuating a broken childcare system that sets everyone involved up for failure. I humbly request that you support H. Bill 46, which would allow Alaska's early educators to operate to raise their collective voice in supporting a viable childcare system. The Child Care Trust Fund will provide annual financial support for the childcare system for years to come. This will stabilize our industry and allow us to continue to provide care for Alaska's children. And I want to thank you for the support you have for quality childcare.
Thank you, Mrs. DeLouch. We have Heidi Pearson in Juneau. Are you on, Heidi?
Yes. Hello. Am I coming through okay?
Yep. Please state your name and go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. I'm Heidi Pearson, and I'm a marine biology professor here at UAS in Juneau, and my husband works for TNH here in Juneau, and we have a 3-year-old daughter. And my purpose today is to urge you to support HB 46. We all know that early childhood education is absolutely critical for the cognitive and social development of our children. And there is much I could share with you about that, but I instead want to use my time to just illustrate the dire need for reliable and accessible childcare in our state. And I want to share with you the struggles my family has had over the past 3 years. So we got on a wait list for childcare in Juneau in April of 2019 when I was 5 months pregnant. And then our name finally came up about a year later when our daughter was 7 months old. And she was able to attend daycare for one day, and then the pandemic hit. And we all know the pandemic was challenging on many, many levels, and even more so for working parents. And now, while much of society has returned to a more normal state, working parents are still facing dire challenges due to these chronic shortages in daycare. And so for us, we've recently had to revert back to what we call full pandemic mode, where we get up at 4 a.m. so that my husband and I can both work a full day and still care for our daughter. And this was due to staffing shortages at our daycare, which left us with little to no care for the past 3 months. So our daycare finally closed in mid-January, and we were really panicked. And once again, my husband and I considered one of us actually quitting our job to care for our daughter. And this isn't the first time we've had that conversation, and this is due to the instability in childcare and the high costs, where it costs more to send our child to daycare than it would to send someone to one of the University of Alaska schools. And so putting parents in a situation where we have to choose between having a job and caring for our child, it's not good for families, societies, the workforce, or economies. We moved here to Juneau 12 years ago for my job, and we've been pretty happy here. But several of our friends with young children, they've left the state, and childcare challenges are one of the factors. And this brain drain and reduction in workforce is not what Alaska needs. We should do everything we can to attract and retain families, and this includes passing HB 46. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Pearson. Next, we have Daniel Voland in Anchorage. Daniel, are you on the line?
I am, and I apologize for the background noise. I'm calling in from a coffee shop.
No
problem. Do you want to hear me okay?
We can hear you. Go ahead and state your name and go ahead.
You bet. I'm Dr. Daniel Voland. I'm an optometric physician and owner of a small business, an optometry clinic in downtown Anchorage. I also represent the North Anchorage District, formerly called the Downtown District, on the Anchorage Assembly. In Anchorage, as in most of Alaska, we are experiencing an acute workforce shortage. We are experiencing this daily in the municipality as we are understaffed at the health department, in street maintenance, in the library, in the municipal attorney's office, and in accounting. The lack of qualified workforce is reaching a crisis level where our ability to provide basic services is being challenged. We felt the impact of this during a recent heavy snowstorm, and with a recent request from the administration for a $2 million appropriation to contract out for supportive accounting services. Additionally, private businesses are having a hard time hiring and finding staff. Before I was elected to the Anchorage Assembly, I served on the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce's Legislative Committee. This was in 2021. We sent out an annual survey to all chamber members. One of the questions we asked is, what were the top factors negatively affecting your workforce? Lack of access to quality, affordable childcare was identified as a major barrier to growing the workforce. So the Anchorage business community certainly acknowledges the great need that working parents are facing and that both small and large employers are facing. The Anchorage Assembly is committed to doing our part to help solve this. For instance, we recently approved an ordinance to put on the ballot before voters the question of whether we should use the marijuana tax to invest in early childcare and education. Still, we need the state to partner with us to help stabilize the sector. Growing our childcare workforce is critical when it comes to growing our workforce in general, and is one key to reversing the trend of outmigration from Anchorage and from Alaska as we continue to make an economic recovery from the pandemic. Until and unless we have enough childcare workers, professional parents may not be able to get back to work and help our economy reach its full potential. House Bill 46 will help revitalize the industry by ensuring favorable working conditions for child care providers and by creating a path for future investment in this important sector via a child care provider fund. This, in turn, will help Alaskan families get back to work and help grow our economy. I hope your committee will consider moving this important legislation forward. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Voland. That's all the folks I see online. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify that has not already? Would the sponsor like to say anything on this bill at this time? So let me say that it's the intent of the committee to hold this bill for a third hearing. We are going to be hearing from leading industry experts during our Monday meeting and have an overview on childcare in Alaska. So we will close public testimony this time. Sorry. And And seeing no other business before the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh.
I did just want to offer, if you want, I did try to jot down some answers to questions previously asked by committee members, so I can run through that now or run through the next meeting. Totally up to you.
Jot down some answers, Mr.
I have a brief slide deck that attempts to answer some of the questions that were raised in the previous meeting, so I can I can go through it now if you prefer,
or later.
If you prefer. Sorry. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Zach Fields, House District 17. Members had a lot of good questions the last hearing, and there's a lot of information. I try to condense it into something understandable. One of the questions was, how much do we pay for child care and who pays? And this is a breakdown of cost for licensed child care providers. The $216 million figure represents essentially what parents pay. $131 million by the federal government is almost entirely, but not quite entirely, the per-child subsidies that follow the child and go to licensed providers. Those licensed providers who are able to accept those slots, those have historically not represented the full cost of care, as you heard from providers. And when you see the $45 million from the state and tribal governments, most of that is for some of your tribal providers, for example, you know, Cook Inlet Head Start. And I would say that's a little bit different from the providers that are addressed in this bill. So what is the burden in terms of cost burden for child care? The McDowell Group reported on this, and percentage of income going to child care, according to McDowell, ranges from 17 to 34%, depending on whether it's a two-parent household or a one-parent household. I think a colloquial way of looking at it is if you're each child in child care is about the cost of a mortgage. And as you see here at the bottom, government assistance is used for a minority of overall child care costs. What is the cost per child? This chart estimates it at nearly $1,000 per month for an infant and toddler. The interesting thing about this chart is I think this actually represents some of our data gaps. You know, if you talk to parents, I'm not aware of a parent who's paying under $1,000 per month for an infant. Most infant costs are closer to $1,200 or $1,300, but this is the most recent available aggregate data. How many licensed child care facilities are there in Alaska? There are currently 431. Most recent figure from the department, licensed child care programs. That is down by over 50 providers from 2021, which is a disturbing loss in child care capacity. We also see a corresponding decrease in the number of child care workers. And this figure is supposed to be full-time child care workers disaggregating from pre-K instructors employed by a school district, for example. And I just did want to add for context, what are other states doing to address child care? Huge number of states across the country are addressing child care, wide range of states, and I just highlighted a few here from Missouri to Florida to North Dakota, and actually child care was, according to one report, one of the largest areas of growth in terms of issues addressed in governor's state of the state. So I hope those answer some of the questions raised by committee members at the last meeting.
Thanks. I would like to recognize Representative Story has joined us in the room. So were there any questions for Representative Fields? Okay.
Thanks again for the committee's consideration.
So seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:28 p.m.